Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Sebastian Younger, the New York Times best-selling author of War, The Perfect Storm, and A Death in Belmont. Sebastian and the late Tim Hetherington directed the documentary Restrepo that won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His latest work is Tribe, on homecoming and belonging, published in May by 12, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing. Tribe is not really about war or soldiers, much as you might expect from Mr. Younger. It's more about me, or us, if you will. There are behaviors, characteristics of soldiers in war, loyalty, interreliance, and dependence, cooperation. If these traits are absent, then those soldiers lose that war. Tribal instincts give birth to these qualities, and a platoon is a tribe. We've all heard soldiers say that they never felt so alive as they did in warfare. In Restrepo, you hear one soldier maintain that you could never achieve in civilian life the high that you obtain from being shot at. So what happens when a soldier bound in such a tribe, a soldier in a way, safe and secure in the most dangerous place in the world, what happens when he returns to America and tries to assimilate into a society that is rife with enmity, insulting behavior, lack of cohesion, racism, political upheaval? Look at this presidential cycle, for God's sakes. How does he slide back into a society that is more alien to him than the land from which he just came? There are answers to some of these questions, or hopes for some answers, and Mr. Younger has attempted, with impressive results, to outline a plan for the future that will allow those who have served our country for a cause, right or wrong, and have gone out on the longest limb, to come back home and belong, home where they have to take you back. Welcome, Sebastian, and thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So you've written and filmed a lot about war, and here is a book that seems to be almost a farewell to that, kind of looking back over your shoulder at what you've seen from a distance. What does this book mean to you, and more importantly, what should it mean for us?
Yeah, I mean, part of the book at the end deals with soldiers and PTSD, but it really isn't the most important part of the book. My book, Tribe, is about the ancient human preference for community. We're primates. We evolved as a social species to live in groups of 40, 50 people in a harsh environment where we basically did everything more or less together, shared resources, shared defense, slept in the same area, knew each other very, very intimately. And interestingly, that's exactly what it's like to be in a platoon in combat or even at a rear base. So soldiers, when they're deployed, they're an interesting test case for me. Soldiers, when they're deployed, basically re-experience our evolutionary past. Modern society is obviously structured in a very, very different way. As wealth goes up in a society, people can act more and more individually. They don't need the group resources. They don't need community interaction in order to survive, which is a wonderful liberation, but there's also a real loss there, because we also know that as wealth goes up in the society, the suicide rate goes up, the depression rate goes up, all things that are mitigated by the communal experience.
Talk a little bit. It's interesting because the preface introduction to this book is strikingly important to the book. So and it's about you. Talk a little bit about that preface, like the story about the offered sandwich, about the guy telling you to slow down, those couple of things.
Well, I grew up in a pretty, well, I don't want to say boring, but I will. In a pretty boring suburb in the East Coast. And, you know, I reached maturity without ever having been tested in any particular way. And I thought that I would hitchhike across this amazing country. I'd never seen it. And I wanted a sort of test for myself. And off I went with a backpack full of gear. You know, I'd saved up some money, and off I went. And I wound up in Gillette, Wyoming, one very, very cold October morning in 1986, I think it was. And And I was stuck outside of Gillette, a very tough mining town. I was stuck outside of Gillette for hours. And it's freezing day, and pickup trucks would go by, and guys would throw beer bottles at me and stuff. And it was pretty miserable. And then I saw this guy walking towards me from town, and at one point, and he looked terrible. I mean, he was clearly homeless. He was clearly sort of living rough, you know. And he walked up to me at a lunchbox, and he said, "Hey, man, where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to California." And he said, "How much food do you got?" And I was just paranoid. I was on my guard. I thought he wanted something from me, and I was just a jumpy kid, you know. And I didn't want to open my backpack up. And I said, "Oh, I just got a little cheese." No, so it was a lie. And I was nervous. And he said, "Oh, you can't get to California on a little cheese. I want you to have my lunch." And so what he told me was that every day he walked out to the coal mine outside town to see if they needed work, if anyone was sick. And today they didn't need him, and he was living in a dead car in town. So he was homeless, living in a dead car. And he saw me out on the highway, and he just walked out to make sure I was okay. And I realized he wasn't just being generous with his lunch. I mean, a lot of people were generous. He was taking responsibility for me. He was taking responsibility for someone that I think on some level he considered part of his tribe. He thought I was homeless like he was. And he basically walked out there to check on a brother. And, you know, I realized there are brothers who you haven't met yet, but you'll recognize them when you see them. And that's what had happened. And I was, you know, he gave me much more than his lunch. He gave me a lifelong lesson about us all taking responsibility for each other.
Yeah, the reason I asked, and that story is so important, is because it kind of is a gnomon for the entire book itself, isn't it? That's basically, if people did that, then there wouldn't be any need for the book, or, you know, we wouldn't have the problems that, you know, you talk about in the book. And it really struck
me. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's a tall order for people in a modern society to act in these ancient human ways. I mean, you know, he acted with a kind of tribal affiliation, which I think was very, very moving and noble of him. But I'm also a realist, and modern society has changed, hasn't changed our genetic makeup, but it's changed our psychological makeup enormously. And so my book is about the very great loss to all of us, not just soldiers, PTSD and all that, really to all of us, the great loss that has occurred with the loss of our communities. I think I make that point without necessarily, certainly without saying, well, there's no upside. There's enormous upsides. But the downside is very, very profound, and I think affects us in pretty devastating ways without us even quite understanding it.
Well, the other side of the coin, and maybe I'm wrong about it being the other side of the coin, and again, in your introduction, which is unusual, when my son first went to work his first job, the guy told him, "Hey, take it easy. You don't want to work this hard." And you have a similar story. Why don't you tell that?
Yeah, I think that's maybe a universal story, because I've heard it many times from many different people. I was working in the highway department of my town, you know, the summer after my first year of college. And I was the college kid, you know, and as a result, I was determined to sort of prove my worth to these older guys. And, you know, you give me a hold a day or give me anything, and I would just attack it.
Right.
And I was busy attacking some hole in the ground, and this older guy walked up and clapped his hand on my shoulder and said, "Hey, slow down. Some of us have to do this job our whole lives." It was really sort of poignant moment for a young man.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, like my son, you know, you give him a job and he runs out the door, runs as fast as he can, gets it done, comes back, asks for another job. And you, your whole life has been exactly that too. But you put it in there, and you put it in there for a reason. So what's the reason? How does that book end, if it does, what the guy did when he gave you the sandwich?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last end of that question there.
Oh, I was just saying, you put both of those in there for a reason, and that second story, the reasoning behind that is what we should all work together to not work as hard, or is this is the opposite of a tribe?
I didn't even have an intent like that. I think I just wanted to place my temporary summer job with these guys in the proper context.
Oh, God.
The context of their you know, real working class lives. And you know, I just thought it was a sort of interesting class thing going on there.
So, again, not leaving the introduction, and I'm sorry for that, I guess, but, you know, you talk about Benjamin Franklin and how astonished and perhaps perplexed and upset he was that there were white men who went to live with American Indians and assimilated there and didn't want to come back, but the corollary was not true at all. And that, again, is like kind of the backbone of your book as well.
Yeah, I mean, I start the book by talking about what we call white Indians at the time, the 1700s, 1800s. And these were people from the settlements along the frontier who either ran off to join the Indians voluntarily. That happened a lot. And as writers at the time noticed, no Indians ever ran off to join civilization. People go native, they don't go civilized. Or they were abducted during Indian raids and adopted into Indian families, and then when given the chance to be repatriated to white society, would often refuse to go or go into hiding so they wouldn't have to return. And this wasn't just men, it was women too. And the reason, as understood at the time, was, and this phenomenon was, by the way, was really troubling to the sort of superior Christian civilized mindset of the day in colonial society. And the explanation, as it was understood then, was that tribal society was basically egalitarian. There really was no class structure. You couldn't really accumulate wealth and pass it on from generation to generation. No one was really born into families of entitlement and power. And this had an enduring human appeal that more than made up for the very obvious sort of deficits of material deficits of a nomadic culture.
In your TED Talks and in the book, you speak obviously a lot about PTSD, and in the book you hesitate and explain to the reader, you hesitate briefly about using that term. Why was that?
Well, I don't hesitate to use it when it's in reference to people's struggle to overcome trauma. But I note that only 10% of the U.S. military is actually engaged in any combat at all. And the rate of disability claims for PTSD is much higher than that. So there's some percentage of veterans who were really not traumatized, who come back to the society, who nevertheless experience a acute psychological distress, alienation, depression. But it's really not trauma. It can't be. They weren't in combat. And to me, it's analogous to what happens with Peace Corps volunteers when they come home. They spend a couple of years in a small village in Cameroon or wherever it is. It's a very communal, connected existence, again, of the sort that we evolved for. And then they come back to America, and it should be a big party, right? Like, what a relief to be back to this modern, wonderful modern society with escalators and air conditioning and everything else. And actually, about a quarter of Peace Corps volunteers slide into a really profound depression, which is probably about the percentage of soldiers that get depressed when they come home. Soldiers, they call it PTSD because that's the sort of term of art right now. But I think for a lot of them, it's technically not.
For a reader, it's so strange, you know, to when you talk about crime rates and suicide rates and how after 9/11, rather than what you might expect, those rates to go up. In fact, they went down, right?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the worse the circumstances, the better humans behave. And
it's
it has
so weird
to be that way. If it was the opposite, humans wouldn't have survived. So evolution has culled the antisocial from our ranks over the hundreds of thousands of years. So when the chips are down, when things are really bad, people cohere. They come together. They act selflessly. They act to the towards the safety of the group rather than their own individual safety. That all makes perfect evolutionary sense. So after 9/11, instead of people sort of turning on each other in a kind of dog-eat-dog mayhem, which is, of course, what some people think happens in disasters, it was exactly the opposite, and it's always the opposite. The suicide rate, these are called antisocial behaviors, the suicide rate went down after 9/11. The violent crime rate in the city went down. People came together because they knew that they needed each other, and that sense of being necessary to your community, to your people, to your tribe, that sense of being personally necessary to others really seems to buffer people from their psychological demons. Admissions to psych wards in London went down during the bombings of World War II, during the Blitz. The authorities were prepared for mass psychiatric casualties, and actually the opposite happened. Admissions to psych wards went down during the bombings. It's a very, very common, that kind of helpful response to catastrophe is very, very common in the world.
Well, along with that, you know, you talk about, I guess I could call it a happiness quotient, and you talk about states like Israel who, as you said, are not insulated. In fact, they have totally no insulation from the potential to be destroyed. Small countries that could be easily gobbled up or just kind of are caught up in the vagaries of the geopolitical situation. But yet, the people in those countries are happier than we are. And it goes back to, you know, this the whole tribal concept, I think, right?
Well, I actually avoid talking about happiness because it is such a subjective thing and so difficult to measure. There are people who study happiness, and it's very, very puzzling. Like, there are very, very messed up countries like Nigeria with high levels of reported happiness, and modern countries with low levels. I sort of stayed away from it because it's so subjective and ambiguous. But what's not ambiguous are mental health statistics. And you can get an objective measure of the suicide rate, for example, because there are dead people, and you can just count them. And, you know, we know as unemployment goes up in this country, the suicide rate goes up immediately, parallel with the unemployment rate, just for example. But more broadly, we know that as wealth goes up in a society, as modernity goes up in a society, individualism goes up. And along with it, the suicide rate goes up. The depression rate often goes up. Schizophrenia, the incidence of schizophrenia rises with urbanization. The incidence of child abuse rises with modernity, with urbanization. You know, affluence and all that bring enormous social good to people. What we don't realize is that it also brings with it a significant psychological hardship.
Well, if we cut to the chase, then and you address this clearly, whose problem is this anyway? I mean, if you look at this election cycle, as I said, whether you're listening to Trump or Hillary, they both play enormous lip service to our wounded warriors, as Trump says. But, I mean, whose problem is this really, and how are you suggesting that it be solved?
Well, it depends on what society is for, you know, and that sort of depends on what life's for. I mean, if the point of society is to maximize our psychological well-being, you know, then clearly we're doing a really bad job of it. If the point of society is, enlightenment, I mean, scientific progress, technological progress, rule of law, philosophy, all of those things, then we're doing a great job of it. And there was, it really depends on, you know, what we all think we're here for as a society. And I think there's a way to have a balance. I mean, I think we can retain the great benefits of modern society in this country and do things that will instill a little bit more of a sense of communal enterprise, of the common good. I think we've entered an era, even the last couple of generations, of people really not thinking in terms of personal sacrifice and of the public good. And there's things we can do to change that. But I don't sense our political leaders talking in those terms.
Well, in Restrepo and in all your war-related books and journalism, and, you know, they are about war, you consistently kind of, you especially in Restrepo, you avoid taking sides, in my opinion, with, like, I guess the rights and wrongs of war. If I asked you whether our recent wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, corollary events in Libya, Benghazi, Pakistan, if I asked you straight out, are those wars just or morally acceptable? Is there any way that you can answer that directly, obliquely? Is there any way that you would feel comfortable stepping out of the role you played as a journalist and a filmmaker in answering that question?
Oh, yeah, of course. That's an easy one. As a journalist, I'm not for or against anything other than I'm against human suffering. And clearly, had America stayed out of World War II, even after Pearl Harbor, fascism would have taken over Europe, would have taken over the world, and there would have been an increase in human suffering. We inflicted a huge amount of human suffering by entering World War II, but I think there was a sort of net gain in human welfare because we entered the war and defeated the Germans and the Japanese. So am I anti-war or pro-war? No, I'm anti-human suffering. And what I would say is you have to look at Afghanistan and Iraq and sort of somehow add up the cost on the one hand and the benefit on the other. And if you come out with more benefit than cost, then they're just wars.
Well, okay. Have you added them up?
Well, I was personally opposed to entering Iraq because I didn't think it would be a just war. I thought it would cause more suffering than it would prevent. And so I didn't cover it because I didn't think I could be objective about it. I was much more familiar with Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan in the 90s, in 2000. I saw the incredible destruction and suffering of the civil war in that country, and the civilian death toll plummeted. It went down immediately as soon as NATO forces and U.S. forces entered Afghanistan after 2001. There was a net gain in human welfare after we entered Afghanistan, and as soon as we pulled out a couple of years ago, the civilian casualty rate went right back up. Furthermore, of course, the attacks of 9/11 originated in al-Qaeda cells in Afghanistan. They were there because it was a rogue nation that was not bound by international law, not accessible to extradition treaties. And obviously there was some real human concerns in terms of more attacks in the West. And we could not have dismantled and eradicated al-Qaeda and bin Laden as we did had we not been on the ground in Afghanistan. So my personal opinion is that there was a net gain in human welfare in our action in Afghanistan, even though there were enormous mistakes made. It was a terribly run war. And in Iraq, my personal opinion is that there was a net loss. But again, as a journalist, I'm not saying we should or shouldn't do anything. I'm here to point out the costs and benefits of decisions we make as a nation.
You know, you brought up how you were in Afghanistan a long, long time ago. On a personal note in the book, why don't you explain, you know, you kind of were just like, you didn't know what to do, right? And so that's what you did by going there.
Yeah, I mean, I was there in 96 as the Taliban were taking over, and then I was there in 2000 with Ahmad Shah Massoud. And, you know, that was back when the Taliban had an air force and tanks and everything else, and, you know, we had a pretty rough time of it. And I came back, and it, you know, I didn't anticipate that this sort of far-off country and this forgotten story that I was trying to tell about the suffering of the Afghan people in the Civil War, they would suddenly become front and center of American foreign policy after 9/11, but it did. And what I, you know, one of the things I started to say was, look, when you allow a country to slide into chaos and remain in chaos for too long, not only is there enormous suffering on the part of the population there, but it's a kind of cancer, and that cancer can reach out and hurt and damage and kill people in Western societies as well. And obviously we're seeing that it's the exact same thing happening in Syria.
Given what you've been talking about, given Syria, for example, given what's going on in politics in America right now and in Great Britain, for example, so how do you think that the ideas, the goals you've outlined in Tribe, in the original article, in your TED Talks. How do you think what you've talked about, how can it be achieved, especially given, like, my jaded view?
Well, we're a modern society. We're not going to go back to living in communal groups of 40 or 50 people that are entirely dependent on each other for their food and their defense and all that. I mean, we're obviously not going to sort of dismantle what we've built. But what I do think is that we can foster a sense of, at the macro end of the scale, a sense of group identity and shared purpose by having mandatory national service. I don't mean the draft. The draft is a wartime measure. I think it's immoral to make people fight a war they don't believe in. But mandatory national service is something that would engage all young people as soon as they turn 18 or 19 and give them the experience of serving their country for a year or two. I think it's a shame that you can't serve your country. I think it's a shame that the only way to serve your country is with a gun.
Oh, yeah.
I think national service would do an enormous amount to make people feel invested in this shared experiment. And I also think that the use of contempt and derision and mockery by people in power for our president, for the government, for segments of the population is incredibly corrosive to the idea of a shared interest and a common goal. And it should be not made illegal. We have the First Amendment, but it should be so severely sanctioned by people that politicians and media leaders effectively don't dare to talk that way.
You know, given your answer, you know, who gave the best advice is maybe your father at the very beginning, and it was advice you didn't expect. Why don't you tell our listeners what he said to you?
Yeah, I got my Selective Service card in the mail in 1980 when I turned 18. I had to register for the draft. Girls don't get this card, but boys. And I was kind of shocked, and I said to my father, you know, I'm not signing this, right? It was right after Vietnam, and I, you know, like, every adult I knew was against the war. He said, no, you are signing it. You don't owe your country nothing. You owe your country something, and we may wind up in another war like World War II. If we do, it's your duty to fight it. And if it's an immoral war, then it's your duty to protest it.
Yeah, and like you said, you were surprised at his response because he was totally against the Vietnam War, right?
That's right.
Your dad, yeah.
Yeah, I was very surprised.
So, Sebastian, me owning an independent bookstore as I do, your work already has a place of prominence in our store. It was a great book and is a great book. So thank you very much, Sebastian, for giving us your time today.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. We were talking with Sebastian Younger, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, published just in May by 12, Grand Central Publishing. The book's provocative. Given the background of Sebastian Younger, who all of you know from the book The Perfect Storm, the movie with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg, and Restrepo, which won the best film at the Sundance Film Festival, which I strongly advise you to watch. Given that as a background, his book Tribe really talks about, and I think he says this is going to be my last book about war. It really talks about, hey, what do we do now since we don't really live in this tribal community anymore? We don't provide the support for not just returning vets, but for people who have served overseas, not necessarily a traumatic situation, but who come back here expecting something. And what do they get? They get, you know, texting. They get a family at a restaurant, all four of which are the mom, the dad, the two kids are looking down the whole meal because they're texting or doing something with their phone instead of communicating. And a very good book. Strongly recommend you reading it because it's very appropriate given where we are today with Great Britain, with Syria, and with our elections coming up in a few months. So continue to join us. We've got a lot of upcoming guests that are really good authors. Ellen Whalen Smith is going to be talking about her book, Oneida, which is about the Oneida Utopian Society and the Oneida Silverware Company and how one became the other. Arturo Perez Reverte, who's seldom translated into English, but his latest novel, What We Become, is really, really, really good. And I think it's well worth reading What We Become. I don't know. It's not like anything I've ever read. And then Leslie Bloom, whose book is Everybody Behaves Badly, which is the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. A great book setting you in the 20s, the lost generation. And the only thing I would recommend, which is what I did, is read The Sun Also Rises once again, because you probably read it before when you were a kid. Read it again before you read her book, because it really gives you the appropriate backdrop for what was kind of a roman, a clef, a clay, in which he used his real-life friends and sometimes extolled them, but at the same time sometimes excoriated them. So that's some of them. We got a whole bunch more. Anyway, so thanks as always, and hopefully you'll be listening in next week here on The Avid Reader.